What we're going to do tonight is Belshazzar's feast, and we will do Daniel in the Lion's Den. On background for Belshazzar's feast, one of the things you might notice is Daniel is called Belteshazzar, and the king is called Belshazzar. The only difference between the two of them being the T-E in Daniel's name. I was reading a commentary on Daniel by a guy named Oliver Green. It's okay. One of the things he said, though, is that Belteshazzar is the feminine of Belshazzar. Belshazzar means, may Bel protect the king, and Belteshazzar is saying that in the feminine. Not sure what the significance of all that is, but I thought it was kind of interesting. So anyway, we're going to do Belshazzar's feast first, obviously. That's Daniel chapter 5. And a little bit of background on Babylon and what's going on here, I think would be useful before we read. I have on the screen behind me a map of biblical Babylon. And there's actually two versions of it. This, I am assuming, is an archaeological map based on archaeology. The description of the city of Babylon was done by Herodotus, a Greek historian, within a century or two after Babylon was destroyed. And he describes the main city of Babylon as a square, 14 miles on the side. This is obviously not quite square, which is what leads me to believe that it's an archaeological-based map as opposed to a commentary-based map by Herodotus. In any case, the place is huge, and as you can see, there's sort of two parts to it. You've got a branch of the river Euphrates that runs through the middle of the city. And when I say a branch of the river Euphrates, that's going to be important. By the way, you can look this up on Google Maps, any place. It's all over the internet, variations on it. And what you want to do is you want to search on Babylonian city map, and you will get variations on this diagram. So the fact that people out in streaming land can't see it is not terribly important, as well as people who are going to be listening to the podcast. Just go on to Google or Bing or whatever your favorite search engine is and type in Babylon city map, and you'll get a variation on this. On my particular map, this area in green is the gardens, and there was enough arable land within the walls of the city that the city was basically self-sufficient. One of the ways that ancients would take a city is they would park an army around it and cut off everything coming in and out, and when the people starved enough, they would open the gates and let them in. That happened to Jerusalem several times. So the idea of a siege against Babylon is not really practical because there's so much arable land within the city, plus they have got a water supply, the Euphrates River, going through the middle of it, and they have, of course, vast stores of food because they're very wealthy. You know, Babylon was the center of an empire, and so it was sort of like Washington, D.C., where the most prosperous counties in the country are right around Washington, D.C. Big government attracts corruption and money. The walls around the main city, everything is made out of bricks. There isn't any stone to quarry in that area because it's on a river bottom. The plain of Shinar is between two rivers, and so there aren't mountains there to quarry rock. So everything is built out of brick. The walls are built out of brick, and I don't remember off the top of my head how high they are, but the top of the wall is wide enough that six chariots could ride on top of the wall abreast. By the way, for those of you who don't know how wide a chariot is, the railway gauge in the United States and Europe is based on the Roman chariot wheel spacing. The reason for that is, of course, they would put railroads on old Roman roads. And the ruts in the old Roman roads told them how wide the chariot wheels were. So they made the gauge space between the rails based on the Roman chariot wheels. So imagine a railroad, now six of those abreast being the width of the top of the wall. And of course, the wall being made out of brick would have been battered, which is to say, slanted out and narrowing at the top. Around the wall is a moat that's fed by the Euphrates River. And then you have an outer wall, which is also guarded by a moat and also fed by the Euphrates River. So the place is very, very difficult to besiege. The end of the Babylonian Empire happens right here in Daniel. Chapter 5 of Daniel, we will see the end of the Babylonian Empire. One of the things that is fascinating, that was in, I believe, 538 BC. I don't remember the date exactly, but that's when the city of Babylon was taken by the Medes and the Persians. If you look at the previous empire, which was the Assyrian Empire, the Assyrian Empire was the one that took out the northern kingdom in Israel, and the Assyrian Empire was conquered by the Babylonian Empire, and that was done in 609 BC. And if you use your fingers and count, you will discover that the Babylonian Empire, which I'm giving its start from when it took out the Assyrians, and its end to today in Daniel chapter 5, is exactly 70 years. And you remember in the book of Jeremiah, God tells through the prophet Israel, hey, you guys owe me 70 Sabbaths because you haven't been letting the land rest every 7 years. So I'm going to put you in exile until you have repaid the 70 Sabbaths. So what he did is he whistled up the Babylonian Empire, and that empire lasted exactly 70 years and then was conquered by the succeeding empire. I always thought that was a fun number. The red object in the middle of the map, the middle of the old city, if you will, is a ziggurat, which is to say a mud brick tower that is some 400 feet high, and on top of it, it has the temple of Bel or Marduk. And I will give you now another view, now that you've sort of seen all this, and the view I'm going to give you is looking from the left side of the current map that you see here. In other words, this map is oriented north and south, like every other map in the world, right? So the image I'm going to show you is looking from the west across the bridge that is over the Euphrates River. This is a medieval artist's conception, and now you are looking at the city you just saw from the east, and you can see there the ziggurat, and notice that there are walls and gates and so forth inside of the city as well. Now, the thing that is going on in Belshazzar's feast, this city, for all practical purposes, is impregnable. Got massive walls, got an army inside of it, got water forever, and got arable land inside that they can grow more crops when they run out of the crops that they have stored. So what's happened is the Medes and the Persians have attacked, and they are coming mostly from the north. That's where they are, the north and the east of Babylon. And they have driven Babylon into the city. So the Babylonians are in the city. They regard the city as impregnable. So the feast that is being thrown here is sort of an in-your-face kind of a thing. We don't worry about you to the extent that we're going to all do a bunch of feasting and get drunk because there's nothing you can do to us anyway. So it's sort of a in-your-face kind of a thing. But this is one tributary of the Euphrates River. The Euphrates divides up north of Babylon, and there are several tributaries of it. And in what is perhaps military engineer's finest hour, Cyrus the Persian dug a cross channel from the part of the river that goes through Babylon over to the next tributary. And what he did then, when he was ready to take the city out, is he turned the water off in that branch of the Euphrates River, shunted that water over to the other branch, and the river dried up, and he walked down the riverbed into the city. He divided his troops into three divisions. One division was diverting the river. One division came up from the south and walked up the river from the south. The other division came down from the north, and the two of them met in the middle of the city and conquered it. Now, part of what may be going on is the Babylonians were so confident of their impregnability, because they've got internal walls and all sorts of other controls in here. So what is clearly going on is all of the government bureaucracy, if you will, who should have been paying attention to security, was in there getting drunk. And so when the water quit flowing and the Medes and the Persians walked up and down the riverbed and walked in, they walked through the place and they killed the king. So what's your historical background? Now, with that all in mind, let's go ahead and read chapter 5. So King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. I don't have any idea how big the bureaucracy was in the city of Babylon, but a fair proportion of them were at this party. They should have had people making sure the guards were set, and I sort of think everybody just sort of relaxed when the commander was in there drinking, kind of thing. That's a guess on my part, that's not scripture. So Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Now, when it says Nebuchadnezzar, his father, Nebuchadnezzar is actually his grandfather. Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by evil Marduk, and then there were a couple of usurpers in there, and then Nebuchadnezzar's line reestablished itself under Nabonidus, I believe. Don't hold me to that, but I think that's right. And Belshazzar was co-regent. In other words, he and his father were both king, and his father was out of town. So his father was out of town somewhere leading a military campaign and had left his son in charge. So this feast was in your face, and it was in your face to the extent that what he is trying to do with the vessels of gold and silver that his granddad had taken from Jerusalem is he is saying, look how great I am. Look how great Babylon is. Look at all of the plunder and so forth we have. We even drink from our enemies' sacred vessels. We are so powerful. That's the attitude that is going on here. Being Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, he surely knows the story of Nebuchadnezzar and the fact that God put him out in a pasture for 7 periods of time. He surely knows that Nebuchadnezzar regarded Jehovah as a definite God not to be messed with, yet he goes on about this, and this is just pride on steroids, if you will. So now we're down to verse 3. Then they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lord, his wives, and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So they are drinking out of the sacramental vessels of Jehovah, and in that they are toasting the idols that they worship. Verse 5. Immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed, and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way, and his knees knocked together. And I would not at all be surprised if he needed a change of linen. This obviously really spooked him, and it probably scared him sober, because at this point he was well into his cups, probably. 7. The king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck, and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." A couple of things here. Notice that this is what Nebuchadnezzar tried. And this same group of people was unable to satisfy Nebuchadnezzar, and that is something that he should have known. Having said that, that's what he did. And the third ruler in the kingdom, remember I said earlier, he's co-regent. So his father and he are both regents. Father is off on a military campaign. He's minding the store at home. So third ruler in the kingdom is as high as he can go. We don't know what Daniel's position is right now. Because A, he should have known that Daniel had been Nebuchadnezzar's right-hand man. He should also have known that Daniel was capable of interpreting dreams and visions. Daniel at this point is an old man. Daniel may be retired, or semi-retired, if you will. Short answer is, Scripture is silent on what Daniel is doing in the meantime. He will get picked up again by Cyrus and made, again, second in command. But right now, we don't know what he's doing. My best guess is he's probably retired, because he's very old. And the king that liked him is dead. And you have a successor administration, a couple of three times successors, because there were some usurpers in between the death of Nebuchadnezzar and his son, evil Marduk, I think only reigned for a couple of years, and then was killed, I believe. And then you had some usurpers in the way. And then we had, going back now to the line of Nebuchadnezzar with his son and grandson. So, short answer is, I don't know. We're down to verse 8. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king the interpretation. And then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed and his lords were perplexed. In other words, now he's really spooked. Nobody can tell him what it is. He's had this mysterious hand writing on the wall. The writing has not disappeared, even though the hand is gone. So he knows it isn't an illusion, and nobody can tell him what it is, but he knows it's important, and he's just terrified. 10. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, "O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Because an excellent spirit, knowledge and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation." Queen, this is probably not his wife. This is probably his mother. Because earlier it says that everybody is drinking with their wives and their concubines. So she's not in the room. So what I'm assuming there, and what commentaries I've read assume, is she's not his wife, she's his mother. So she's the queen mother. Obviously she knows of Daniel. And the thing that's interesting to me is why Belshazzar doesn't immediately go for Daniel. Verse 13. Then Daniel was brought before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you." Depends on what translation you have. Some translations will have, "Are you Daniel?" My translation says, "You are Daniel." Could be either one. It's formal, so it may not be condescending. You are Daniel from Jerusalem that my grandfather conquered. Come on in. Or it could be, all right, come here, slave, because we conquered you. No indication which way that is. However, from Daniel's attitude, it may well have been snotty. Verse 15. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation. But they could not show the interpretation of the matter. Now I have heard that you give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Same offer he made to his wise guys. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your awards to another. In other words, shove it. You got nothing to give me that I want, is what he's saying there. And I don't know that Daniel has an opinion of this guy. I'm sure he probably does. And his opinion is obviously not very high. But he also, I believe, knows that this guy is not going to be able to make good on his promise. So the idea that you're going to give me a third of the kingdom, you're going to lose the kingdom tonight there, bucko. So a third of the kingdom isn't worth much. Daniel's interpretation does not set a time frame. The narrative says that it happened that same night. The comment was, verse 14, I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, which is English Standard. And New King James, I have heard of you that the spirit of God is in you, singular. And it's almost surely the word Elohim, which can be translated either way. So if you're talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you are using the word Elohim, it is singular. If you are talking about the gods of Babylon, and you use Elohim, it is then plural. And I am guessing that the translators of English Standard assume that since he was a pagan king, that it was plural. But that's a guess on my part. The comment was that the word is not Elohim, which is masculine, it's Elohim, which is feminine, which indicates that it certainly does not refer to Jehovah. So it would be pagan gods then. Back to verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let your gifts be for yourself and give your awards to another. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. In other words, you got nothing I want. You're not able to bribe me, but I'll go ahead and tell you anyway. 18. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind and his mind was made like that of a beast. And his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox and his body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. So Daniel is cutting him no slack and says, you should have known better. And you remember last time we talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar actually had three warnings. He had the dream that Daniel interpreted of the great image. He had the deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the furnace. And then he had Daniel's interpretation of his own dream. So he's got three warnings. So when he doesn't take that to heart, God knocked his knees out from under him and put him on all fours in the field. And what Daniel is saying to Belshazzar is, you knew this. You knew the God you were dealing with, and here you bring the sacred vessels of this God who did all that to your grandfather, and you bring them in there and disrespect them by having your wives, your concubines, and everybody else drink liquor from them. Bad move. That's what he's saying. 22 again. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heavens, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords and your wives and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze and wood and stone, which you do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hands is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. In fact, you have not only not honored him, you have disrespected him, although you should have known better. 24. This is still Daniel speaking. Then from his presence, the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed. And this is the writing that was inscribed. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Pharsin, or Tekel, Upharsin, the U is an and. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Peres, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, and a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So Belshazzar at least kept his word. That's what he said was going to happen, and he does it. Not that Daniel particularly cares, because he realizes that third ruler of a conquered kingdom is not going to be a big deal. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And I've already explained how that happened tactically. They drained the Euphrates River and walked up the riverbed. So that's the handwriting on the wall, Belshazzar's feast, whatever. There's several really good pieces of music written about this, by the way. If you want an interesting piece of classical music, look up Belshazzar's Feast. It's quite good. Yeah, a comment from somebody out online was, it could be Hunter Biden. Yeah, which shows there's nothing new under the sun. So now we're going to go to Daniel and the lion's den. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps would give account, so the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. What isn't clear is how he knows about Daniel. It is not stupid, once you've conquered somebody, to find who ran the place before and bring them into a room and get their attention and say, all right, now you go back out and keep doing the job you did, but now you're working for me. That's an entirely possible scenario because they know, you know, where all the plumbing is and they know all the people and all that kind of stuff. So if you can get some of that human infrastructure to continue to work, then the nation that you have conquered will continue to run and will continue to generate tribute and all that kind of stuff. So it's entirely reasonable to bring on some of the administration that you have just conquered. But we said earlier that Belshazzar, Daniel wasn't somebody that was on his radar. His mother had to remind him about Daniel. So as I guessed, I thought perhaps Daniel was retired at that point. So I'm not sure how he shows up in this position. So verse 3 again. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. In other words, once Daniel got rolling, it was obvious to Darius that he was the real deal. And the other nice thing about Daniel from Darius's point of view is he's not a Babylonian. He's a Hebrew. He's been conquered by the Babylonians. Babylonians, in turn, have been conquered. he doesn't necessarily have any particular loyalty to the old regime. They conquered me and I've worked for them. All right, he's conquered them, now I'll work for them. That may be part of it too. Verse 4. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground or complaint or any fault because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." First thing is, obviously, this is the deep state. They do not like Daniel. During President Trump's administration, I was just flabbergasted with the amount of investigative power that they turned on that man. They tried every which way to find some dirt on him that they could smear him with and get rid of him. And we seem to have elected the cleanest man in the country because they weren't able to find anything. And that's what's happening here with Daniel. The deep state doesn't want him, and so they're trying to figure out some way that they can get him impeached. They can't find anything, so what they're going to do is they're going to set him up. Does that all sound familiar to anybody? What goes around comes around. Verse 6, then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, "Oh, King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects, the satraps, the counselors, and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction." What's going on here? You got a new leader in town, and very common in that time, in that part of the world, that a king was regarded as a demigod. And so in order to establish, you're the king now. So what we want to do is for 30 days, we want to make it a thing that no petition will be to anybody but you. And that will get everybody on the same sheet of music that you're the king now and the gods favor you, and that will get them in the habit of regarding you as the legitimate king. And Darius says, cool, that sounds fun, and signs it, not realizing, of course, that he's being mousetrapped. Verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before the God as he had done previously. So Daniel knows what's going on. He knows he's being set up. He does not deviate. Verse 11, then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. In other words, they know his routine, and so what they do is they wait until he's going to be in a time of prayer, and they show up with witnesses. Ah, there's Daniel praying to somebody besides the king. So it's entirely a mousetrapping operation. Verse 12, then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, "Oh, king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, should be cast into the den of lions?" You can see that butter wouldn't melt in their mouth. The king answered and said, "The thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked." Then they answered and said before the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes petition 3 times a day." And the king heard these words, was much distressed. The king realizes he's been mousetrapped. He knows exactly what's going on. Daniel has been set up and he's fallen right into it. Verse 14, then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored till the sun went down to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said, "Know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance of the king established can be changed." So he's trying to find a loophole and can't find one. And they are now, "Well, what are you going to do, O king? You know what the law is." sort of reminds you of the pious stuff that we hear. Nobody's above the law when they are doing nefarious stuff. Verse 16. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you." And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with the signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. And the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. So the king is on Daniel's side. He recognizes what's going on. He recognizes how unjust this is. He recognizes at the moment there's nothing he can do about it. Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, "Oh, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm." So what's happened here now is the law has been fulfilled. The law only says you got to put him in the lion's den. The law doesn't say he's got to be eaten. So, all right, the law said I got to put him in the lion's den. I put him in the lion's den. Not my problem that the lions didn't eat him. Now, come on out, Daniel. Your sentence has been served. 23. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were brought and cast into the den of lions. They, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So what goes around comes around. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel." This is very much like what Nebuchadnezzar wrote. "For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So where we're going to go next is we're going to start getting prophetic stuff. This has all been historical narrative, if you will. Now we're going to get Daniel's visions and prophecies and a whole bunch of other stuff. So that will be the next section of the book.